have met worshipfully in God's ever-challenging presence. This letter serves only to put into visible form the binding ties centered on the Spirit which we have experienced. From this base of our being, we are free to turn outward to you all and to the world with living greetings. We are encouraged by the developing quality of unity among friends around the world. We are all one body of Christ, and thank God that the church, the body of Christ, is now developing diverse gifts among us. Some of us would serve to repair bridges which have fallen into disrepair, while others would build new bridges where none had existed. Yet we would all find direction in the twofold prophetic command from Isaiah. In the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Access to livelihood and privileges accorded other citizens. We have felt led, after consultation with Native American leadership in Washington, D.C., and numerous other friends, to seek the establishment of a friend in Washington concerned with Native American affairs as an adjunct to the Friends Committee on National Legislation during 1975. Nebraska Yearly Meeting has pledged a sizable portion of the cost of such a program, but we will seek assistance from other friends as plans move forward. We covet for all of you the rich experience of Christ's presence, which has been ours during these days together. On behalf of Nebraska Yearly Meeting and Friends, Don Reed, presiding clerk.
Concerns. We have concerns about problems with alcohol, and that is one of the most serious problems with Indians. They say one-third of all Indian deaths are alcohol-related. And about prisons. Many times as many Indians are in prison as whites proportionate to their population. And education, we're interested in education, but Indian education outmoded, inadequate, and inappropriate. It is frequently designed to destroy Indian communities, to make Indian children unfit to return to their communities. We're concerned about hunger and there is starvation on Indian reservations. And employment has been mentioned here in the meeting. Unemployment on Indian reservations is 50% and up. About civil rights, been mentioned. Some are denied them. Other inappropriate ones are rammed down their throats. We believe in the separation of church and state, but some Indian communities do not. We destroy them by imposing our kind of civil rights. And racism, basic to all the problems. We think that Indians and friends can help each other. At Ithaca Fraternal Conference last year, Rari Hookwatz spoke to friends, very well received. He thanked friends for past help, help that enabled Indians to continue to live as Indians. Said that perhaps the time has come when Indians can return the favor and help friends continue to live as friends, not just like everybody else in the mainstream. You might say on the main line. He said that we should be able to tell our children that we have done things to help Indians and not just that William Penn did. One of the ways that friends can help Indians, I think, is being exemplified by Nebraska here at the meeting, whose minute you have just heard. And that program in Washington with the Friends Committee on National Legislation and the Friends in Washington for Indian Affairs, the two of them, are now working for us. But the budget has not been completely raised. They're going on faith. And when I was there, they pointed a finger at me and said, but Philadelphia hasn't sent as much. They need our help. I think our speaker today, Gordon Harris, who wrote that Nebraska hearing in a minute, can show us that the courts have not been able to solve the problems arising out of wounded natives. And the executive branch certainly hasn't. Maybe we may have some hope for the legislative branch. So let's support the work of our friends in Washington. They need $5,000. And Rari Hookwatz, also speaking to friends at Ithaca, suggested that one way that they could help would be in having an observer at the state trial. The service committee did have an observer at the federal trial in fall. But nobody was looking at in on the state trials at Lincoln and at Pierre. The Associated Executive Committee took that up. Friends at Ithaca raised considerable money. And the service committee assisted in locating Gordon Harris, our speaker today. So he will tell us something of his experiences as an observer at the state trials this past summer of defendants of the wounded Negro. Gordon Harris, pastor of Friends Meeting in Central City, Nebraska.
Thank you, Ted. I am indeed from Nebraska, recently so, actually, about a year and a half that I've been out there. For those of you who don't know Nebraska, that part of the country that has severe winds and cold during the winter, because there's nothing between it and the North Pole except one little pine tree just south of Winnipeg. When the summer gets so hot, let's say, that the corn on the stalks pop, they fool the cattle, and they all freeze to death, thinking it's snow. But it's good to be here. I appreciate the invitation. I'm sorry that I did not bring a cabinet minute with me, as I also have. Perhaps the minute that was read can serve that function. Yesterday, I was in Council Bluffs, Iowa, at a trial in federal court there being held to judge whether young Indian man who was guilty of crimes committed, allegedly committed at Indian Knee. Before trial started in the morning, those who were interested in this young man, in this case, gathered in a small room, witness room, and a religious service was conducted by an older man by the name of Philip Deer. White would refer to him perhaps as a medicine man, and our terminology. I'm not sure all of this happened. I do know that a peace pipe was lighted, the words said over it, and then it was passed around the circle. Those who knew the proper things to say said them in the true language. The rest of us, their reverend wife. I told the pipe up back to Philip Deer. And somehow strengthened and went into the courtroom. In this particular case, the judgment of the jury depends largely on the question of whether one of the witnesses is or is not an Indian. This would seem like an easy question, but in point of law, it is not. The young man in question himself said that he was 3/16 Indian, but whether that was enough to satisfy the law or not, it was under question. If he was Indian, then according to the law, apparently, the court had no jurisdiction and it should go to a tribal court. And if he was not Indian, the trial would be in the right spot. I tell this story because the issue, as I see it, at stake in all of these trials, is the confusion on the part of whites, and to some extent on the part of Indians themselves, as to who is an Indian and what is an Indian. What is it to be an Indian in the year 1975? Not 100 years ago, but in 1975. Well, one group of Indians on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota thought they had an idea of what an Indian was, at least a Sioux Indian, or a Lakota Indian. I won't use the word Sioux. Sioux is a French word, not an Indian word, and it's actually a mistranslation, a mistake. The correct terminology, and the terminology they use among themselves, at least the traditional Indian, is Lakota. And they went, this group went to Wounded Knee. Wounded Knee is a small town inside the reservation. They went to Wounded Knee to hold a meeting, a protest meeting. Exactly what happened at that point is what is before the court, and that's what's before the court. The Indian story is that they went to hold a meeting and were immediately surrounded by federal forces, BIA forces, that's the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And the town was laid siege to. You'll often see in the paper the reference to the occupation of Wounded Knee. I think the more accurate designation is the siege of Wounded Knee. first called a siege rather than an occupation. Just previously, within a month previously to this event, and this is February 1973, approximately, in January, a young man was killed just outside the reservation, a young Indian man. He was killed by a white rancher, a businessman in town, a customer. When the man was brought to trial, was arrested and brought to trial, he was not charged with murder, but with manslaughter. And eventually he was let off with a suspended sentence. A group of Indians, led by the boy's mother, Sarah Badhart Hall, went to Custer to seek to present their grievance of this dual standard of justice. Trouble started, again, the question of how. The police came in with gloves, and there was a fight. But somehow only Indians were arrested, some 30, including Mrs. Batter, called Corey's mother. The rest went back to the reservation, joined with those going to Wounded Knee. So we had two very quick events, one leading into the other. It has been confusing to many people as to what the status of the trials were. I'm going to take just a couple minutes to try and straighten it out, because it's important. There are actually, at this point, three levels of trial going on. There are federal trials in the U.S. court, there are state trials in the South Dakota courts, and there are municipal trials in the Sioux Falls, South Dakota court. And these are all related to the similar events. The Custer incident, which preceded Wounded Knee, happened outside the reservation. Therefore, the cases stemming from it were placed in state court, state jurisdiction. These are the cases that Ted was referring to. The Wounded Knee cases, the Wounded Knee situation happened within the reservation. That they, at the Wounded Knee trial now being held, are in federal courts and divided between they were divided into leadership and non-leadership cases. The leadership cases were, you may have read, were Russell Banks, Banks and Means were the two who were acquitted last fall in St. Paul, Minneapolis. The rest of the cases, there is most of the rest of the cases, so-called non-leadership trials, were taken to Lincoln, Nebraska, under Judge Irvine, Federal Judge Irvine. Those cases have now been moved to Iowa, for reasons I'll get to in a minute. In the federal cases, at this point, if my notes are correct, out of about 125 people charged, there were four leadership cases, two have been acquitted. 40 or 50 other cases have been dismissed or acquitted. There have been two guilty pleas and six, only six convictions after your trial. The state cases, the country cases, went to Sioux Falls. Four people have been tried so far. Sioux Falls is here, the capital of four people have been tried thus far, and all convicted. Those four, the first person convicted was the mother of a young man, and she was sentenced to 1 to 5 years, but thankfully is now out of prison. During the trial, the judge, fellow by the name of Bottum, B-O-T-T-U-M, did not have respect of Indians that he was trying for various reasons. They refused to stand when he entered the courtroom, which is the custom for any of those of you who deserve to trust. There is no law that they must. It is purely a courtesy. Judge took this as contempt of the court, which is a strict language as well. And despite pleas from religious leaders and others in the courtroom to deal with the situation in another way, he brought in riot police, tear gas and gloves, and proceeded to forcefully eject people from the courtroom, most of them to jail. These are the cases stemming from this incident are the municipal court at top. And they are underway at this very moment. The state cases are not being tried after the four who were convicted. Those trials are at a standstill largely because the state of South Dakota, as well as many other states, requires that a lawyer and its trial, an attorney, be from the state of South Dakota. And although most of the Indians being tried are from South Dakota, they are having difficulty finding a lawyer in the state who will stick his neck out for the very unpopular kind of trial. This is only one of the unfairnesses. There are many lawyers throughout the country who would very much like to aid in those trials, but are unable to do so without at least one lawyer in South Dakota. I started going to the trial in July. Started with the Sioux Falls trial. Found that Mrs. Van Hartbolt had already been convicted. I tried to attend her sentencing and was told that outsiders, that nobody but the press was eligible. It was a public trial, but the public was not invited. So I stood outside with many others, mostly Indians, who waited for the verdict. I wish I could describe adequately the pathos of this mother of five children, one dead, and she came out crying to say goodbye to her other children before they took her off to jail, having received any kind of deal thing. It was a sad day. I next went to Lincoln to look in on the trials there and found the situation better. Most of the Indians being tried were being acquitted. In fact, up until December, only four had been convicted. And when those four were convicted, everybody in the court was tried. It then appeared like that all the Indians would be acquitted. So the spirits of the defense group in Lincoln was much better than it was in South Dakota. But it appeared to me that the justice was still not being done. Justice, in my estimation, is more than a matter of guilt or innocence. It is more a matter of relationship. Again, coming back to the question, what is the Indian? What is the relationship of an Indian to himself, herself, and to white society? This was what Wounded Knee was all about. I don't believe there was ever any real chance, any real hope of a chance of staying at Wounded Knee. The hope was, I'm convinced now, that once the case had gotten to court, that the judges would find a way of figuring out what was the just relationship. And there was no other way to get it into court without this kind of strong demonstration. So far, up until December, the government, both of South Dakota and the United States, were treating the situation purely on a law and order basis. There had been shooting, there had been trouble, but somebody must be guilty. They were refusing, for the most part, to deal with the larger issue of relationship. What is the just relationship between Indians and whites? Then in December, Judge Warren Erbaum agreed, federal judge, agreed to a hearing to determine whether a treaty signed in 1868 defined this relationship was still in force. From the very beginning, from the very days of the siege of Wounded Knee, the Indians have been talking about the 1868 treaty. Why were they there? Because the 1868 treaty said this is our land. This is their land. The treaty has many parts to it. On the bench out here, put some newspapers in which it's about the treaty, and I would invite you to take a look at it. It's an important document. But the treaty signed in 1868 said in effect that half of what is now South Dakota, parts of Nebraska, parts of Wyoming, belong to the Indians and would forever and ever. Interpretation was that this meant this was a sovereign country. And therefore, any alleged crimes committed there were not the business of the United States. Again, my use of the word siege rather than occupation. This drama at Lincoln attorney for those who have been convicted said that their convictions were illegal because this is not part of the United States. The hearing took place in an old-fashioned I-7 courtroom. During most of the 13 days of the hearing, from December 16th to January 7th. And the jury box was filled not by jury members, because this is only before the judge, but by the elders of the Lakota Nation, the traditional people, who sat there great dignity to the whole proceeding. More than 100 Native Americans, were brought before the hearing. And it was an historic occasion because this is about the first time that the Indian case for all time was able to be presented in a courtroom of the United States. There were other tribes represented besides the Sioux. There were Cherokee, Mohawk, Crow, Potawatomi, and others, but mostly Sioux, Lakota. There were men and women, some young children who had been brought by their parents to see that this historic occasion. The elders received much deference. At one point, court was held up while those who had found seats only in the back of the room, those elders, were encouraged to exchange seat places with younger folks sitting through the court. And I became convinced as one by one they came forward to testify, these elderly people, that the charge that the Indians were being manipulated by a group such as Ames was false. They had a story to tell which came from far deeper sources than the political activities of the past decade. In fact, Russell Means, one of the primary leaders for Ames, testified in the witness stand that he had nothing to add to what the elders were saying, and that he could only repeat what they had told him. This was a formal judicial hearing, but Lakota spiritual leaders like David Spotted Horse and an Iroquois spiritual leader by the name of Francis Booth were allowed to give prayers before each session of the court. And most of the witnesses took their oath not on the Bible, but on the Indian peace plan. Somehow it didn't seem out of place. The witnesses were the traditional people themselves, many of them speaking in Lakota, the Lakota language, using translators, saying simply from their oral history what they understood the treaty to be. And then there were experts, many of them, historians, anthropologists, who came and told the story of the relationship between whites and Native Americans, different from what most of our textbooks tell us. story is not the story of misunderstanding of what it meant to be an Indian and how the false information was given out. I was privileged to be here. I only wish that the whole thing could have been televised. I think many Americans would have learned a great deal from it. And I think they would have watched. The drama was so hot. The stakes were so hot. This was a real life and death situation. The life and death of a whole culture, of a whole society. The defense put on testimony for almost 3 weeks. The prosecution, the government, put on only one witness. And that witness, a historian from South Dakota, for the most part agreed with the defense witness. I subsequently got a hold of his decision and read it. He had obviously put no thought into it. It was a fairly long document. I don't agree with his conclusion. I think he was wrong. He admitted rather forcefully that much of what the Indians had said was true. Laws that had taken the land after this treaty were unjust and wrong. But he concluded that they were the law and that he was sworn to uphold the law. And therefore, even though the laws were unjust and wrong, he must rule against them. He also stated that this was a political decision to be handled by the executive department and the legislature, and not the court. I had thought just the reverse, that the court was a place where justice is a matter of relationship, was to be decided. But he said no. This is up to the executive and the legislative body. I think this is a matter of passing the buck. It was quoted to me a while, I think Ted was telling me yesterday, about the situation in which he was told, or he heard from a legislator, that a certain situation involving treaty rights should be taken into court. So the government proceeds to throw this back and forth. The judicial department says this isn't ours.
executive department, to the legislature, the legislature to the judiciary. And Indians say, well, we tried. We tried your way. And they didn't work. And here we go again. Same as it was 100 years ago. And nothing has been settled. If all those yet to be tried are, whether or not they are convicted, they are all convicted and sent to prison, or if they are not, issued behind wounded knee, behind custody, would not have been solved. What is the just relationship between two people living on the same continent? This, I think, is the issue. And who is going to decide? 100 years ago, they tried to decide it with hope, with weapons. Wounded knee, I should have mentioned earlier, for those who might not know, was chosen as the meeting place for Heinrich's civil rights group back in 1973, because this was a symbolic place. A place where in the 1890s, hundreds of men, women, and children were massacred by the United States Security, and then buried in a common grave. There was no trial of any church, of any soldier at that point. We tried to settle it that way 100 years ago, and it didn't work. And the question keeps coming back, and it will keep coming back, in the form of activities of one kind or another. We've seen them just this year in Wisconsin. Last year, and continuing to the present in New York State, among the Mohawks, who's taking over a piece of land. This past week, in Nebraska, an Indian took over a factory on the tribal land, but they said it was being run the tribe, and they wanted to run it themselves. Type of thing will continue to happen, I'm convinced, until somebody makes a decision, until somebody is found to decide what is just, what is a just way of living. It's not an easy answer. It's not an easy question. I don't indicate that. As Judge Durbaum has said, that yes, the Indians, the Sioux and South Dakota, the Lakota and South Dakota, are a sovereign nation. You can imagine the difficulties involved in a sovereign nation surrounded by the state of South Dakota. But those difficulties are not an adequate excuse, in my estimation. The trial is for one. Let me stop there. It's important that we keep them in mind. The issues probably won't be solved by them, but they are human beings. There's some 30 to 50 people yet to be tried. And these are human beings whose lives have been disrupted by not knowing what's going to happen next. that time to the present, they had a goal of whether they were going to be tried or not.